Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honor, Alice Cox was fired as a jailer at the DeSoto County Jail because she reported a beating by deputy sheriffs and a jail trustee of a mentally disabled inmate. There are two claims that are before the Court. One is her claim under 42 U.S.C. 1983 for a free speech violation. And the other one is a claim under the Age Discrimination in Employment Act anti-retaliation provision. At the time she was fired, she had a suit pending under the Age Act. So there are two claims that are here. The one I'd like to focus on, I believe the United States Supreme Court in the Astoria case is already settled that there could not be any collateral estoppel as far as the age claim is concerned. So I'd like to concentrate on the 1983 claim and why we believe that the Court erred, Your Honor, in granting summary judgment on the 1983 free speech claim. Your Honor, assuming, and I understand this panel has to adhere to the Stafford case, it's already been decided, I understand that, but even in Stafford, this Court recognized that we look to state law, and under Mississippi law, or even if we look to a federal law, there's a settled, established beyond question rule, which is that we do not give collateral estoppel effect to a decision of an administrative agency if there's reason to be suspicious about its reliability. That's a standard under the state law. Is there reason to suspect the reliability of this decision of the Mississippi Employment Security Commission? Your Honor, just to hit the highlights, this Mississippi Employment Security Commission, in the first place, is based on nothing but hearsay. There is no, none of the officers that were there were called as witnesses. Ms. Cox tried to call the jail trustee who was there, and the referee just ignored that. So there is no evidence of anybody with personal knowledge about what happened other than Ms. Cox's testimony. They called the officers, two of the officers that were on the board and two officers that took statements, but they didn't call anybody with any firsthand knowledge. And second, Your Honor, I hate to have offended counsel, and I hope I didn't, by saying that his deputy sheriffs lied at the hearing, but there's just no other way around it. That's what they did. When you read the statement of this mentally disabled prisoner, it's impossible to say that that prisoner said, well, they didn't do anything wrong, and that's what they led the referee to believe that he'd said. Now, he goes on and on in his statement, but he very plainly says that he was assaulted there. That's in the transcript. And so,
but whether he was assaulted or not, didn't she say, I saw him hit by this jailer, and then later on said, well, I didn't actually see the hit, I just sort of inferred the hit. And wouldn't that by itself, regardless of what actually occurred, be enough to say, you know, you misled us into saying you were an eyewitness when really you're more of an inferential witness?
No, Your Honor. I think Your Honor has made the same kind of statement that was made by the referee, that she said in her statement, I saw. That she never said, I saw. She said, this is what happened, what I observed. And here's her explanation when she asked about it. I didn't see the fist make contact. What I saw was the hand going down. I heard him yelling, oh, my back. And then I heard the deputy sheriff bragging about how he had hit him in the prison, how he'd hit him.
Well, I'm not saying she necessarily confessed to intentionally lying. What I'm saying is it's important to be accurate when you're making a report like this because it's a very serious charge against a jailer that he abused an inmate. So if she misstated what she actually observed, even if she did it with a pure heart, nonetheless, they could say, you know what, you misstated things to us. We can't have you doing that, and we're going to fire you for that basis. And it nonetheless be consistent with the fact that he was actually hit.
All right, Your Honor, for court, please, if that's true, if that's an argument that's going to be made, that's a question of fact to go back to
that
the jury.
That the referee decided.
That yeah, doesn't go to the collateral estoppel issue.
But that's what the referee found. The referee found that she misstated what actually she saw. And that is a fact question that was decided against her.
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that at all. Here's what the question is whether the court is going to give collateral estoppel to what the referee found. And whatever the referee found, he based it on this. He based it on what the officer said that the prisoner said. And he based it on hearsay that this is what the Sheriff's Department has found after investigation. There's reason for suspicion as to the liability of the findings. That's the question. It's not whether we're going to uphold the referee's finding as being based on the facts. Let's assume Your Honor's right. And there's a factual basis for the referee's finding. That's not the question.
That's what the referee found. You just finished saying that. The referee said you misstated what you actually saw.
Your Honor, the issue is not whether we're going to uphold fact findings of the referee. The question is whether we're going to give collateral estoppel effect to the decision of the referee. And you cannot give collateral estoppel effect if there's reason to be suspicious about his findings.
But
it's not whether...
Counselor, that's what my point goes to. My point goes to the fact that there is a basis that has nothing to do with what the jailer said for what the referee found, that the referee, in fact, articulated. And in that case, it wouldn't matter if these jailers said one thing or another. If she misrepresented what she saw, that's a serious thing and could result in her firing, and we can give collateral estoppel effect to that.
Your Honor, the reason it's improper, I mean, Your Honor's a court, so you can give collateral estoppel if you want to, so I don't mean to say you can't, but the reason I'm saying it's improper to is because the test under state law is whether there is reason to be suspicious about the reliability. The reason to be suspicious about the reliability is because the referee, when you read his opinion, he based it on hearsay. He based it on what these deputy sheriffs said the Sheriff's Department has already found. And he refused to allow her to call her witness. Let's assume he's got, assuming for the sake of argument he has a factual basis. I don't really agree that he has, but I'll take Your Honor's view of it. He has a factual basis for his decision. That's not the question. The question is whether it's to be given collateral estoppel effect. That's the question. Your Honor, the only argument here to me that's even halfway or even halfway approaches anything that Your Honors could base the decision on, I might say this to interrupt myself and say this. If Your Honors should extend Stafford and say that we're going to give collateral estoppel effect to a non-judicially reviewed decision of an unemployment commission, that will go beyond what any United States Supreme Court decision has ever indicated or what any court of appeals
Well, should that be the test? Because let's suppose that it was a full and fair hearing. You know, witnesses were called, rules of evidence were complied with, and there were findings. And then the plaintiff said, you know, yikes, I lost. And I don't want to be collaterally stopped by this, so I'm not going to appeal. I mean, that's not really a sound basis, is it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand your question.
We shouldn't base it simply on whether there was an appeal or not, should we? Because there could have been at the initial administrative level a full and fair hearing. Witnesses called under oath. Everybody had their day, and in fact findings were made, and the plaintiff loses. And she says, you know, if I appeal, I'm going to be bound by collateral estoppel, so I'm just not going to appeal. That shouldn't be the test, should it?
Well, it may not should, Your Honor. I agree that it shouldn't, and the United States Supreme Court justices have commented on that very thing. It probably shouldn't be. But the problem is that that's, you know, under the full faith and credit clause, if there's a judicial decision, then that decision has to be followed. And that's why I advised him the way I did. There is a distinction between whether you appeal and there's really no meaningful appeal. It's an appeal on the record. In other words, the referee never saw this statement by the inmate. That was never introduced, and that wouldn't have been before the circuit judge. But whether it should be or whether it shouldn't be, the fact is there's a difference between a judicially reviewed decision and one that's not judicially reviewed because of the full, and I agree, I mean, for what it's worth, I agree with Your Honor that it probably shouldn't be, but that's the way it is because of the full faith and credit clause. And I do think, Your Honor, there's so many Supreme Court cases that's dealt with this area. But the one that's mostly directly in point, the University of Tennessee versus Elliott, which just the general rule is you give collateral estoppel effect to a state administrative hearing. That's the rule. I'd like for Your Honors, if you are reading that case and believe that that controls, it's very important to see that the facts of that case are so different than this case. In that case, it was a race discrimination claim that was adjudicated by state court, a state administrative hearing. And then there was a federal race discrimination case, exactly the same issues. In this case, what we're talking about is an adjudication of the meaning of the term misconduct under the state unemployment statutes. And then we're talking about a free speech claim, two totally different things. So that's why I say that if Your Honor should say, well, this case is controlled by Elliott, in effect, we've gone far beyond what Elliott held or what any other case or court of appeals held. I've cited numerous cases in my brief where other courts of appeals have said, well, unemployment hearings are too different than 1983 suits to be given collateral estoppel effect. The state's interest, the state wants to have these hearings quickly. This hearing was held within 3 weeks. Normally, I understand the rules say she could be represented by counsel. She wasn't. I didn't even know she was doing it. But she goes down trying to get her unemployment benefits, and the state wants to make a quick adjudication so as to give a person that can get her $210 worth of unemployment benefits, those benefits started. It's done quickly. I looked at the statutes. There's no case dealing with whether you can have discovery in it, and the statutes are not clear, but I'm not aware of any discovery that's ever been held in an unemployment hearing. So they want to get a quick adjudication of unemployment benefits, whereas a federal 1983 claim, we do lots of discovery. We get this statement by this inmate. We go, instead of doing hearsay, we go take the depositions of these nurses. We cross-examine the witnesses by attorneys. It's a totally different animal. So we believe that Your Honor should not extend. I understand Your Honors are bound by Stafford, but I urge Your Honors not to extend it when it's not judicially reviewed, and also not to extend it to 1983 claims.
Let me just ask you this. Let's assume for the moment that collateral estoppel does apply. In your reply brief, you make this argument essentially a mixed motive argument. Did you make that, or could you point me in the record where you made that argument in the district court, a mixed motive argument, as opposed to a just don't apply collateral estoppel, don't do it, don't do it?
Your Honor, I'm so sorry. If Your Honor would allow me, we've written so many detailed briefs, I feel like I made the same arguments, but I can't look at the record and say that I can't represent the court that I did. I'd have to check to see whether I may not have. I don't know whether I did.
Okay, and I mean, that makes a big difference to us, because I'm not sure we can reverse based on a mixed motive argument that's raised for the first time in a reply.
Well, Your Honor, I see Your Honor's point. I'd have to look at the brief to see exactly what I did. But to me, the whole what we have here, Your Honor, is in effect a decision that frustrates both federal policy and state policy. The federal policy is to have remedies, to have compensation, to have deterrence for violation of constitutional rights. The state policy is to get quick adjudications of unemployment claims. So this type of decision. First of all, as I said, I advise clients now after Stafford, don't go file for unemployment, because if you lose, that's going to be the end of it. So that's the situation that we're in until Your Honor says otherwise. But it frustrates not only the federal policy of trying to provide remedies, but also the state policy of getting quick adjudications of unemployment hearings. Your Honor, there's another case that I need to discuss that I feel like that would be the primary basis of which Your Honor could rule for the defendants, and that's the Raoli case. The Raoli case is cited in the defendant's brief, and it's a case where the Mississippi Court of Appeals ruled that if there's an unemployment hearing and you don't appeal, you can't then file an independent action and raise the inadequacy of the unemployment hearing. In other words, they can do that as collateral estoppel because you didn't appeal that up to the state courts. Your Honor, with all deference, we believe to apply that state rule would be inconsistent with the 42 U.S.C. 1983 policy of providing a remedy for constitutional wrongs, and with such cases as Monroe v. Pape, that says the whole purpose of 42 U.S.C. 1983 is to provide a federal court remedy. So if Your Honor say that we're going to allow this state court decision to keep us from providing a federal remedy, we believe Your Honor would not be acting consistent with Monroe v. Pape, and I'd also cite a case that's not cited in my brief, a United States Supreme Court case of Herring v. PROSIE, 462 U.S. at 316, and then there's a case from this court that I did cite in my brief, the American Airlines case, that basically says that a collateral estoppel rule would not be applied where it contravenes strong federal policies. And that's the case we have here. There's a 42 U.S.C. 1983 policy.
The collateral estoppel effect would only be as to what was specifically decided, I suppose, by the administrative proceeding. And what was that question? What specific question did that administrative body answer?
Your Honor, really goes to the heart of the case. That, in my opinion, properly read, they decided there was misconduct under state law for purposes of the Mississippi unemployment statute.
Well, they didn't decide anything as to any free speech.
Well, No, of course not. Yeah, that could not have been before him, and that's the distinction.
So that was only issue preclusion and not claim preclusion as to Section 1983.
Was not and could not have been, Your Honor, and I think that goes back to the Elliott distinction. The case decided in Elliott was a race discrimination. The case before the court was race. This case is a free speech case. The case before the Unemployment Commission was misconduct under the purposes of the state unemployment statutes. So, Your Honor, I think that makes the major points, if Your Honor doesn't.
Yes, you've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Wade.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lacey?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Steve Lacey on behalf of DeSoto County, Mississippi. I would like to first try to refocus and frame the issues from the county's perspective. To begin with, Ms. Cox filed her original complaint in 2003. After filing her original complaint, DeSoto County invested in her continued employment by sending her an officer training course, in particular on how to be a jailer. After completing that course in October of 2004, it was only about 2 weeks later when she reports the incident. She submitted a written report that specifically stated that Sergeant Winters punched an inmate in the back after he was down and handcuffed. The county took that so serious that Internal Affairs decided not to handle that themselves and sent it to the district attorney's office. The district attorney then concluded two important points. One, that no criminal conduct on the part of any jailers occurred. And two, that Ms. Cox had given an inconsistent statement. Based on the inconsistent statement, and consistent with what Judge Haynes said, these are serious allegations, and you cannot have in a jail jailers accusing other jailers of criminal conduct when in fact it didn't happen. Everybody knows that.
Well, whether it happened or not, would it be sufficient misconduct for her to have misstated what she observed? I mean, that was kind of my question to your opponent, is if she said, Sergeant whoever punched the inmate, when in fact all she saw was him raise his fist and then she heard him yell or something, but she didn't see the punch, would that be enough misconduct to fire her?
Under that scenario, I'm not so sure, but what the testimony was that she was fired for knowingly submitting written information that was false. And what
but the falsity, as I understand from the questioning by the referee, is she didn't actually see what she said she saw.
That's correct, but she did write something that she did not see.
Okay, and so that was what I understood the referee to be critical of, that you are reporting an event that you're basically making an inference, but instead of saying you made an inference, you reported it as if you saw it.
I agree.
In other words, I saw the gun in your hand and the body on the floor, but I didn't see you shoot X, but I told everyone you shot X.
I think that what's important is also in her testimony in front of the referee, she testified that without a whole bunch of assumptions, that she could not make the statement that she made. And part of the problem is what we had is an inmate that was out of control, and in fact, officers were brought in to take him down. And the investigation by the district attorney's office concludes that it's really a proper escalation of force. So what she saw is and what she wrote are in opposite to each other. She, in fact, wrote that she witnessed a punch after handcuffed and down, and then subsequently had to recount that and did not see it.
And that disparity alone is enough misconduct, I guess, is my question, without regard to what other people said and hearsay and the inmate and all that.
Yes, Your Honor, okay. Because it's putting in writing in a current investigation through Internal Affairs and through the district attorney's office, it's something she did not see. So it, in fact, violates a
just
county
put
policy.
A fine point on it. What actually did she see?
The best it can be told from reading the transcripts of what she saw was basically the officers go in and take him down. At some point in the record, I do not recall the page in the record, she admits that they went down on the ground and she could no longer see him. So it's difficult, as she stated in her testimony, without the assumptions of the scuffle of what she
heard. He was handcuffed.
Pardon?
He was handcuffed.
It's not clear in the record at what point he was handcuffed. My understanding is that he was taken down because he was out of control and yelling expletives and throwing things around the room. He was taken down to the ground. And when the handcuffing actually took place, we're not positive. After being terminated, she in fact applied for the unemployment benefits. And as we've already noted,
Do you concede that her age discrimination retaliation claim survives even the most favorable to you application of collateral estoppel?
Your Honor, I move for summary judgment on the issue preclusive issue, and if that had been brought up at the district court level in response to our motion for summary judgment, I think that I would have to concede that the age discrimination issue would not have been precluded. However, we suggest that that issue is waived. The reason that that issue is waived is because after the granting of summary judgment, there was no motion for reconsideration.
In her opposition to your motion, she did say, to the extent plaintiff's claims are based on the anti-retaliation provisions of the ADEA, collateral estoppel does not bar these claims.
Yes, Your Honor.
So she's made the point, I mean, maybe not as well or as forcefully or as beautifully as she could have, but she made the point in the trial court, so we can consider that point here.
I think you can consider it, Your Honor, but I think that I still think that it's waived in that the main body of her argument had to do with First Amendment issues as to whether or not that the document that she wrote was the reason she was fired. That particular statement that you read was buried in footnote 1 in an argument where they actually conceded that our argument was correct and that's the law, that she should be issue precluded from re-arguing her termination claims.
The rub is always in the footnotes, isn't it?
Yes,
ma'am. And while we're on the subject of what was preserved below, was the mixed motive argument made below in a footnote, in a midnight filing, in anywhere?
No, Your Honor, okay. And I don't believe the mixed motive analysis is proper. It was raised for the first time in the reply brief.
Okay.
I think that back on the collateral estoppel issue, I think that it's consistent. I think that the counsel opposite somewhat agreed that Stafford is the issue here. And in considering our motion for summary judgment as it pertains to the 1983 claims, the district court relied on Stafford. Stafford was, in fact, a decision involving the Mississippi Employment Security Commission. And plaintiff admitted at the time that was the decided law of the district. Part of their brief mentioned that this court has never considered non-judicially reviewed cases. However, in an unpublished opinion, Russo versus Jefferson Parish Water District, this court, citing Stafford, addressed this very issue and stated that if a state agency decision is unreviewed, then the law of the forum state determines whether the agency decision has a preclusive effect. In line with that, the Mississippi Supreme Court has decided in Smith versus University that, number one, res judicata or collateral estoppel does apply to to administrative proceedings, and that once an agency decision is final and the decision remains unappealed, that collateral estoppel still applies.
Okay, what if we were to spot you that general rule, it doesn't matter what's reviewed or unreviewed, as long as you had the opportunity for review, you didn't avail yourself too bad. But here she's making an extra point, which is there's something suspect about this particular proceeding. Even if all the other proceedings in Mississippi are golden, this particular one is hearsay piled on hearsay, and the lying DA, and or allegedly lying DA, and the allegedly lying sheriff, and everybody's lying and covering up and misstating and misrepresenting. Does that change the analysis?
If they had come forward with some evidence that was in fact true other than their bare allegations, it may. In the record, there is nothing to indicate that the officers lied at the hearing. The officers that testified at the hearing are officers who were either involved in the investigation and they testified as to what they learned, or they were on the board that actually listened to the testimony to decide whether or not she was going to be terminated. In addition, I think key about whether or not there is false testimony or not, I need to point out one other thing, Your Honor. Today's the first time I've heard anywhere in the record, and it is nowhere in the record, that the inmate in question was mentally disabled. Counsel mentioned that earlier. I'm not aware of that. It's never been mentioned before. But part of the investigation revealed that even the prisoner, the inmate himself, did not agree that Officer Winters punched him. In fact, at the record at 994, the question was, Officer Winters, did he ever hit you with anything you felt uncalled for? No, sir. Did he ever go too far? He just pinned me down and put handcuffs on. That's far different than, and so we would not agree that there was false testimony at the hearing on that issue.
By anyone other than her?
By any of the officers that testified.
I thought he testified that he saw this fist coming down, he turned his head because it was, would hit him in the face, otherwise it hit him in the neck.
He does make that statement somewhere in the statement, but not as to Sergeant Winters. In the melee that required taking him down and getting him under control, who all knows what happens, but what he was absolutely clear of was that Sergeant Winters never hit him.
Well, so really this whole, I mean, what we have is an out-of-control inmate. You've got to do something with him. You have to get him under control. There's procedures for that. You can't just start pounding on the guy. But there's procedures for that that may be different than if somebody's being compliant and you just, and they put out their hands and you just put handcuffs on them. That's your point. And so her observations, what she really saw, do matter in this whole discussion as to whether they employed proper procedures to physically take him down or whether they were just pounding on him improperly. Is that what you're saying? I'm just trying to understand this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that her testimony about what she really actually observed is very critical in this whole analysis of whether they properly sort of physically handled him or they improperly physically handled him, because there's no question they physically handled him, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
There's one other issue in the record that I'd like to address, and I don't know if the court wishes to entertain it, but it's to whether or not the individual defendant's claims are properly before this court. We believe that, in fact, that the individual defendant's motions are, and the grant of dismissal are not properly before this court. Appellant chose to designate a specific defendant's motion. She specifically designated the order granting our summary judgment as to DeSoto County. In fact, what it says it specifically is the order granting defendant DeSoto County's motion for summary judgment on plaintiff's termination claim. I think what is maybe more important is what it does not say. And what it does not say is that they're appealing the motions granting the individual defendant's motions to dismiss. And as a general principle, we think then that she has failed to meet the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 3C1B with that regard, and that the only issue properly before the court is DeSoto County's motion for summary judgment.
Didn't she appeal the judgment?
Well, like I said, Your Honor, I think the notice of appeal is specific, and it says the order granting defendant DeSoto County's motion for summary judgment on plaintiff's termination claim. And it does not mention the individual defendants, which were motions to dismiss.
Yeah, but she says, let's see. This order and opinion became final on November 20, 2007, when the court entered the final judgment. And doesn't the final judgment dispose of everybody? Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. The judgment does deal with all of the individual motions in one memorandum opinion and order. And had that been mentioned as a whole, we think there's a distinction in there that she specifically stated DeSoto County's motion. The individual defendants brought separate motions. The Attorney General's
right, but she appeals from the final judgment. I mean, again, if we were teaching a class in appellate procedure, we could write a better notice of appeal, but is that really the standard?
I think that is the standard, Your Honor, and I think that that is set out in Ingram versus United States by the Fifth Circuit at 808 Fed Second 1075. And with that, Your Honor, we ask that the collateral estoppel order be affirmed, And in addition to the collateral estoppel issue, we think that if the court wants to entertain, there's an independent basis for summary judgment. And although the district court did not specifically, let me back up. Although the court did not address the First Amendment issue, I think it's important here that there's an independent basis upon
this
which
summary judgment. Is this
Garcetti? Yes, ma'am.
I'm just wondering, on record site 15, paragraph 15 of her complaint, it says, during her interview with Defendant Dunn, Plaintiff Cox told Dunn that she had recently completed 2 weeks of training where she had learned that it was her responsibility as an officer to report any misdoings that she witnessed, even from fellow officers. Is that a concession of Garcetti?
I believe it is, Your Honor, and that's exactly where I was headed. I think that in applying Garcetti, you look to that paragraph 15, and in addition to the county's policy that states an officer or an employee of this agency shall immediately report so on and so forth, violations of policies, procedures, guidelines, et cetera. And with that, Your Honor, if I would entertain any questions.
All right, thank you,
Mr.
Lacy.
Thank you.
Ray, you say time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Court, please, I'd like to first return to what Judge Haynes was saying. Did I pronounce your name correctly, Judge Haynes? Was saying right at the start of the questioning. Your Honor was saying, well, for purposes of state law, this may have been misconduct if she misstated in her testimony that she was basing it on what she derived, what she heard admissions of rather than what she saw. That might, I think the point Your Honor was saying, that might be misconduct.
Well, if she says she saw something she didn't see, is that misconduct?
Well,
is that the law?
First place, I don't think that's accurate. I think that's what the referee said, but in any event, assuming that Your Honor is correct, that points out why there should be no collateral estoppel here. Because the standard for a free speech violation, that is, they make intentional false statements or in reckless disregard of the truth, may be entirely different from the standard of what's misconduct under state law. So that emphasizes exactly why collateral estoppel should not be applied here, assuming Your Honor is correct. Now, let me go to the Garcetti.
Well, collateral estoppel would go to why she was fired.
Well, what Your Honor is saying is that may constitute misconduct under state law. That doesn't mean
it. If she was fired for misconduct and you don't have a mixed motive claim, then how do you win on the First Amendment?
Because of this, Your Honor, what's the First Amendment standard under New York Times v. Sullivan? Intentionally false or reckless disregard of the truth or it's constitutionally protected speech. If she inadvertently makes a false statement, it can still be protected speech. So Your Honor's questioning actually highlights why we should win because the issues are different. All right, Your Honor, on the Garcetti issue, Your Honor, this very point was made in the Williams case that we just there's just a reported case on in Williams. We had that same situation where same counsel involved argued that, well, you've admitted that you have this seminar where you're supposed to report misconduct. I believe it was Judge Barksdale that wrote the decision, and he would say, well, under normal sheriff's policies, that's correct. That'd be a part of your duties. But we have evidence in this record that the policy is what goes on in the jail stays in the jail. The three plaintiffs in Williams have filed affidavits in this case that they had witnessed beatings, but they understood that they were to keep quiet about it. That, in fact, although there may be a written policy of reporting false statements, although she may have been to a seminar that you're supposed to report false statements, in fact, the policy of this sheriff was if it goes on in a jail, you better keep quiet about it. And that's not just from Ms. Cox. That's from these three other deputies in the Williams case. We filed their affidavits in this court. Your Honor, let me close by commenting on the appeal. And Judge Haynes, I agree. I did a very poor job on that notice of appeal. However, if Your Honors would look.
I didn't mean to be rude. I was just saying it could have been better written, but I think you made the point.
Thank you, Your Honor. On page 382 of the record, Judge Mills did what he called an administrative dismissal without prejudice of these individual defendants. It appears that it was his intent that he was going to deal with those issues after this raised judicata issue was decided. And the other reason I was doing that appeal the way it was, I was trying to distinguish between the termination and those earlier claims on the wrongful transfer claim. But with that, Your Honor, unless Your Honor has further questions, that's complete my argument.
Thank you, Mr. Wade. Your case is under submission.